Onward. Any follow-ups from what we've just been talking about? The fettering thesis. Okay. A third critique of the grand theory is about the base superstructure argument. And it's typically, the criticism is framed as a critique of economic reductionism. Now, the base superstructure connection is an important part of the general theory of history because it helps to explain why it is not simply the case that the trajectory of the forces of production help to explain the economic structure, but why this also explains other features of society, non-economic institutions. That is, there needs to be a systematic connectivity between economic structures and non-economic structures in order for the development of the forces of production to explain the broader contours of the society rather than just the narrower issues of economic structure. So you can imagine if we lived in a world in which the state, politics, ideology, culture were completely unconnected to the nature of our economic institutions. They were just autonomous institutions that did their own thing, that satisfied other needs for human beings, that had their own rhythms of development, and had no intrinsic causal connection to the economic structure, just contingent ones. They just happened to be whatever they happened to be, but they weren't necessary connections. They weren't inherent in the way societies work. Then even if the other parts of historical materialism were true, even if it was the case that the forces of production tend to develop in history, that they functionally explain the relations of production, that when they're fettered, the relations of production change, etc., even if all of that were true, it wouldn't explain anything else. Everything else would have its own autonomous, separate theoretical explanation. Well, what the base superstructure argument tries to do is to anchor key aspects of non-economic institutions in their connection to the economy, and the anchoring is again done through a functional explanation. Ideology, culture, politics are the way they are because of the functions they serve for reproducing class relations or the economic structure understood in class terms. Well, people criticize that on the grounds that there are many aspects of these non-economic institutions which are not really explainable in that way. The most notable form of this criticism in recent years comes from feminists, I think, who powerfully argue that there's all sorts of crucial aspects of gender relations that can't be explained by the dialectic of forces and relations of production. But the same argument can be raised about other kinds of social relations, ethnicity, race, nationality, as well as other kinds of institutions, besides those dealing with other types of oppression or inequality. What's the response to this? Cohen proposes that the way to reconcile the obvious fact that not everything is explainable by the functions required by the economic structure, how you can reconcile that with historical materialism, he proposes introducing a distinction between what he calls restricted and inclusive historical materialism. The intuition behind this distinction, I think, in a way it's pretty obvious once you think about this, which is that historical materialism doesn't imply that the theory explains everything that's non-economic, but only those non-economic phenomena which are part of the superstructure. Thus, not everything which is non-economic is in the superstructure. The superstructure is a very specific way of thinking about aspects of ideology, culture, families, churches, and so on. Namely, those aspects which stabilize economic relations. Cohen gives the following example about religious practices. In the Church of England, the Articles of the Creed have exactly 39 articles. No one would imagine that the explanation for why it's 39 rather than 38 or 37 could be explained by historical materialism. That is, what historical materialism is only meant to explain is why the church has whatever features it has that help stabilize economic relations. Those are the aspects of the Church of England that are superstructural. The parts of the Church of England that bear on the question how to stabilize and reproduce the class structure. Everything else about the church that doesn't bear on that is explained by other forces. Historical materialism is meant to explain what Cohen describes as the features of religion that are relevant to the problem of reproducing social structures, not features which are irrelevant to that problem. Now, of course, it's not so easy to specify exactly what's relevant and irrelevant, what's most important, what's less important. This opens up all sorts of cans of worms. It's much simpler if economic structures functionally explained everything non-economic, but it would be a preposterous theory. You know, nobody really can think of economic structures as having that kind of explanatory power. Restricted historical materialism tries to provide a criterion for what it is that defines the irrelevance of a property for the theory. Therefore, restricted historical materialism tries to give some reasonably clear criteria for knowing what, in fact, it's meant to explain. And you could think of it this way. Historical materialism, in its restricted form, explains those properties of non-economic institutions that are consequential for stabilizing the relations of production. Again, the implication of this is that one should not make an identity between superstructures and non-economic institutions. Rather, one should say, superstructures are those aspects of non-economic institutions that are consequential for stabilizing economic relations. Cohen gives a really interesting example of this in his discussion of the Protestant ethic and the spirit of capitalism. Did I mention this particular thing in an early... As I've said from time to time, I don't always keep close track of what little digressions and illustrations I've used. Okay, so it's this really interesting point. There's nothing more central in the history of sociology than that text. That's one of the classic texts, Weber's Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism. If you haven't read it, you should. It's a very readable book, super interesting, in which Weber basically argues that the religious doctrines of Calvinism played a crucial role in generating capitalism. And this is often used as a critique of Marxist accounts in which capitalism would explain the Protestant Reformation rather than the Protestant Reformation explaining the emergence of capitalism. Right? So the basic base superstructure argument says that it's by virtue of capitalist relations that a particular kind of doctrine comes forth to reproduce those relations. You need that kind of ideological religious institution to stabilize the relations, but not that for exogenous reasons those ideologies come forth driven by the internal development of religious battles, and it has the consequences of generating capitalism. That was then viewed as a critique of the base superstructure view. Well, Cohen says, let's look at it more closely. You know, that's one of the features of functional explanations, is that a functional explanation does indeed say that Protestantism is crucial for capitalism. It doesn't deny that. It just says that that explains why you get it. Whereas the theology-driven view would say, no, it's internal dynamics inside of the corruption of the Catholic Church, the emergence of Lutheranism, and then the playing out at the level of the logic of religious institutions and their battles, that drives towards the predestination view of Calvin, which then triggers the Protestant ethic, which then triggers the development of capitalism. that it's an autonomous stream of causation in the dynamics of religion, rather than a functional explanation, that doctrinal form emerges because it's functional for capitalism. Okay, so how could you possibly distinguish these two? What evidence would you use? Well, Cohen cites some research, which is a fine-grained account of the sermons given by Calvin over some extended period of time when he moved to Geneva. And the argument then is the following, that restricted historical materialism would say that Calvin develops these sermons, this particular doctrine, in response to the needs of an emerging capitalism, rather than capitalism emerges because of this sermons. Well, how could you distinguish this? Well, what happens is, over the course of the development of his sermons, they become more and more predeterministic. The doctrines which are distinctively thought of as the Protestant ethic doctrines are only weakly present at the beginning and very strongly present at the end. And Cohen's reading of this historical fact about the development of the sermons is Calvin is a preacher. He speaks to these bourgeois types in his congregation. Some of his speeches, his sermons resonate, some don't. He is in a kind of experimental mode of trying out these theological doctrines to see which ones work, given the lives people are living. And the ones that work are the ones that give people confidence and assurance about the holiness of what they are doing. And the Protestant ethic emerges in response to the needs of proto-capitalists, rather than capitalism emerges as an unintended consequence of the sermons themselves. Well, that would be a restricted historical materialist interpretation of Weber's observations. And it comes then from a fine-grained account of the development of the ideology itself in response to its engagement with the capitalist, emerging capitalist world. Restricted historical materialism then becomes a plausible theory, whereas inclusive historical materialism is simply not. And usually the theory is stated in a form that doesn't make that distinction. That would then be Cohen's response to that economic reductionist criticism. It's economic functionalist, but only for those aspects of non-economic institutions which are functionally needed for the reproduction of class relations. Finally, the transformation thesis. A central element of the general theory of history is that when a particular class structure fetters the development of the forces of production, when that happens, when you get fettering, when long-term stagnation sets in, those relations will eventually be transformed into more suitable relations of production. Right? That's the key point at which you actually get a successive stage. So if you have a stage model in which this trajectory across stages is punctuated by crises, you need some mechanism by which the crisis gets resolved by moving to the next stage. And the transformation thesis is the formulation of that idea. Such transformation requires a transformative agent. New relations are actually produced by people who build them. That's true in the transition from primitive communism to pre-capitalist class society. Some people had to get together and organize their capacity for subjecting other people to a regime in which surplus was extracted from them and they were forced to work longer as a result. Whereas in the previous social order, that wasn't the case. So it means that there has to be people capable of that collective action. You need transformative agents. In the case of capitalism, as we'll see in the next lecture, there is a plausible argument, which turns out to be flawed, but there is a plausible argument that capitalism produces its own gravediggers. That's the classic formulation, that capitalism produces the historical agent capable of collective action to transform capitalism. But there's no reason to believe that this should be true in all possible class structures. And again, Marx and indeed Cohen never argue, give an argument for why one should, as a general matter, imagine that collective agents emerge capable of actually producing the transformations in question. There are a couple of problems here. First, it may be the case that whenever material conditions of life deteriorate, people will have interest in changing relations in which they live. That's perfectly reasonable. You know, you have some kind of stable modus vivendi where it's not that life is great, but it's predictable and things are going along okay. Certainly reasonable to believe that when conditions of life deteriorate, people have an interest in transformation. But why should people have an interest in transforming social relations simply because the future development of the forces of production are blocked? That is, that's not the same thing. You can see why people would have an interest, at least, in transforming society if conditions are getting worse. But the fettering and transformation thesis are an argument about the need to transform relations to unblock the forces of production, so that they can further develop, especially in modes of production in which the development of the forces of production are slow anyway. Why would there be agents always emerging with a clear enough understanding of future possibilities and an interest in modeling those future possibilities? So unless fettering triggers disruption of the material conditions of life, unless the blocking of development of forces of production makes life worse for people, you know, if blocking makes life worse for people, it's hard to imagine where the motivation for transformation comes as a general rule. Right? So remember, the general theory has to say that this is an inevitable general tendency, that interests and motivations for transformation will be triggered by the fettering of the forces of production, so that the relations can be broken to unfetter them. Well, why should anybody be motivated to do that as a general matter? But also, even if actors have interest in transformation, it's not clear that interests generate capacities for struggle. This becomes the acute problem for the diagnosis of capitalism, the acute problem for the special theory of capitalist development, which we'll be looking at Thursday, is even if you can imagine very strong and potent interests on the part of actors in transforming the system, there's no reason to believe that interests themselves generate capacities. Now, it can be the case in some specific situations transformations can be predicted. You know, I think, gave a pretty credible argument for the emergence of classes out of pre-class societies, that once a surplus was available, at some point there would be attempts by people, if just for kind of random stochastic reasons, to realize the potential of that surplus. And as long as it succeeds occasionally, you will get then the transition from pre-class to class society. We can tell a story, at least, to make that plausible. But in more complex societies, where you already have developed class structures and power relations enforcing the existing relations of production, why, as a general law-like rule, should we imagine that the capacity for transformation is called forth by its historic necessity? In the absence of such capacities for class for transformation, permanent stagnation becomes possible. So in spite of the development thesis, which says the probabilities of advance of forces of production are greater than the possibilities of regression, What this says is that in the absence of a capacity for transformation, permanent stagnation becomes possible. That is, you can have social relations of production, superstructures which permanently stabilize a set of relations of production, which permanently block the development of the forces of production, because there's no reason to believe that even in the long run, a capacity for systemic transformation will be forthcoming. I don't see an argument against, I don't see a counter-argument to that point at the level of abstraction of the general theory of history. I don't think there's a way of reconstructing historical materialism at the abstract level that solves this problem, why the capacity for transformation is called forth in the long run just because the existing structures impose constraints on the development of the forces of production. Now, it may be possible that we can solve this problem for the special theory of capitalism, and after all, that's the only one we really care about. It doesn't matter, so to speak, if the theory can't explain why in Chinese society in the 17th century, in its sort of classic imperial form, when the forces of production were fettered and the relations of production were very stable, why no capacity for internal transformation would emerge there. Who cares, in a way? We only care about that because of the way it might inform our understanding of the transformation of capitalist relations. But perhaps the special theory can solve this problem. So perhaps what we have then, one could imagine a reconstructed historical materialism which says, we have these general tendencies in history, but they don't give us actually a trajectory of overall history. What we have then is a general theory of history which may lead to permanent stagnation, but a special theory of capitalism which explains why that isn't a long-term possibility in capitalism. That is why the transformation thesis holds for capitalism, even if it doesn't hold more abstractly in general. If that can be well established, then you don't need the general theory. You can just go with the theory that matters for the concerns at hand. Yeah.
Could you still say that whatever the likelihood of it? It seems like the main problem here is then explaining the transformation to capitalism, because you said there is a plausible story of transition to non-capitalist class society.
Right. So there's a plausible story. It may still not satisfy the conditions of actual historical materialism. I mean, there's more to talk about if we really want to sort that out.
So you can't say that, you can't have a theory of the necessity of a transformation to capitalism, but still you can say that whatever the possibility is, if it shows up somewhere, then it will be stable and expansive.
Right, but the reason for the emergence of capitalism are not the historical materialist reasons.
Right.
It's not because capitalism fettered feudalism that feudalism was destroyed. It's that capitalism developed and that... So this is a difference. This is not the classical historical materialism. Capitalism develops. It's a dynamic system. People are drawn to it. This is more the neoclassical economist story. Capitalism wins over feudalism just because it's more efficient and people like it and they move towards it and they defeat the opponents of it. But it emerges inside of feudalism as a just set of practices which are connected to feudal practices for many decades, perhaps centuries, as proto-capitalist relations. And then it triumphs just because it generates more capacity for example, military expansion, all these other reasons. But it doesn't emerge because feudalism fettered the forces of production. So the question is whether it emerges for contingent reasons, the particular geographies of cities and states in the multi-state European context is what allows for merchants to develop a niche capable of expanding to become corrosive to capitalism, to feudalism. And that has nothing to do with the fact that feudalism did or didn't fetter the forces of production. capitalism is superior with respect to the subsequent development of the force of production. That superiority is what enables it to triumph. But it doesn't emerge because of the inferiority of feudalism. It doesn't emerge because of some crisis of feudalism which calls forth capitalism. So it's a different kind of account that doesn't fit under this general, overarching general theory. It emerges out of a specific theory of the spaces of autonomous economic action within feudalism. If feudalism was ever a pure feudal society, capitalism couldn't have emerged. It's because feudalism itself was a hybrid within which these non-feudal forms could emerge and develop a symbiotic relationship with feudalism and then expand to the point where they began to be corrosive of feudalism. That's a perfectly good story, good theory, about the emergence of an alternative inside of feudalism which then replaces it. And we could develop similar accounts, as I try to do, of the emergence of non-capitalist forms within capitalism that eventually can become dominant through various kinds of struggles and transformations. But those are not subsumable under a general theory which says whenever you get class relations, you get subordinate hybrid forms which end up corroding the dominant forms. It's a historically specific account of the emergence of new relations under old structures and the contradictions and tensions that produce, and a structural sociological account of the constraints and possibilities of transformation under these different kinds of conditions. But it is not concrete instances of a more abstract theory. This is a difficult point about these levels of abstraction, about general theories and special theories. So I keep sort of repeating the point in different ways. Is this clear enough, or is there still some fuzziness here? Yeah.
Well, it seems like one of the difficulties in understanding is that it's still that capitalism is inevitable. It's just that the path is not what historical materialism specifically specified.
Well, it's only inevitable in those pre-capitalist class societies where proto-capitalist relations could emerge. And it is not inevitable that in all pre-capitalist class societies, proto-capitalist relations emerge. It happens to be the case in the Eurasian Western, in the Western peninsula of the Eurasian landmass. There were particular historic conditions and possibilities where that kind of hybrid form could emerge. But it wasn't a generic feature of pre-capitalist class societies that was inevitable somewhere. Now, one could make the more general argument, perhaps, look, if with enough, you know, and I've made this as a gesture, with enough time, with enough variation, you know, with enough asteroids to wipe the slate clean and start over, so to speak, with the fortunate occurrence that the place on the planet which had the right geographical type conditions also had coal, you know, in abundance. I mean, there are all sorts of really contingent facts of our planet which makes the emergence of steam power on a large scale possible. That it just happens to be the case that coal is easily mined in the surface at a time when that was the technology to get at it. Just imagine what the possibilities for the Industrial Revolution would have been if coal was only available in deep mines, so you didn't find it near the surface. You know, those are super contingent facts about geology that make our planet susceptible to capitalism, so to speak. Well, I don't know if that would be a fatal flaw to a planet if it didn't. You know, a good argument can be made that it would be a fatal flaw for an otherwise wonderful planet for human beings in which they could emerge, because the emergence of human beings does not depend upon the availability of iron close to the surface or malleable metals. But you could imagine a planet with all of our conditions but with no easily mineable metals. So you never get the Bronze Age or the Iron Age. You know, you just never get metal implements. And without metal implements, it's pretty hard to see how you do get the forces of production to develop to the point where capitalism really becomes possible. You know, so those are super contingent features of physics and geology, which our species, combined with those contingent features, do mean that the forces of production don't get stuck at the Stone Age. If they got stuck at the Stone Age because stones were the only available things that you could beat into tools, so that our tool-making capacity was limited to stones, I think we would have sociability. You could probably have settled agriculture. I don't think you need iron implements to figure out that you can plant corn. But you would not get high-density civilizations with long-distance trade, I don't think, in a world with only stone implements. You might get the elaboration of all sorts of cultural forms. Our aesthetic drives and our search for meaning were all well in place before, you know, iron, as it were. You look at the caves of Lascaux, and it's just awe-inspiring, those pictures of the depth of human engagement with the natural world and how people experienced it aesthetically. You know, it's astounding. Those 40,000-year-old cave paintings. So there's no question you could get culture without it. The question is whether you could get capitalism without it. Yeah.
I'm confused about the distinction between industrialization and capitalism. Because it seems, you know, in early Europe, you had primarily agriculture with a few towns, and then some of these larger producers would start trading and start producing agriculture for a surplus.
Right, right.
And that was well before industrialization.
Right, right.
That was pre-capitalist.
Right, right. So it was sort of proto-capitalist. So you could, my quip was without iron. Well, of course they had the kinds of ships you can make without nails and the kinds of transportation you can make just out of wood that is hewn with stone axes is pretty limited, way more limited than in early modern Europe. Right? So whether that would be a foundational constraint on the ability not to engage in some trade, because and there are places in the world without iron. There are human civilizations that had no, that were permanently in the quote Stone Age and still had plenty of culture. They had religion, they had culture, they had all this other stuff. But they didn't have capitalism. And they had limited trade. The point of this is just to emphasize the higher level of contingency in the actual historical trajectory we have. So this is a simple-minded form of contingency that just comes from the availability of certain kinds of raw materials. Although it should be taken seriously, it makes you think that the number of the conditions for planets to produce high levels of civilization may be way more precarious than just nice benign climate. Still, that's one form of contingency. There's plenty of others, though. That means that while I continue, and this is a tension in my own views, so I continue to pretty strongly believe, yes, if you reran the tape of the Earth 1,000 times and didn't put any constraint on the time frame, you're going to get global capitalism sometime. And in our planet, in our particular history, it took, starting from 100,000 years ago, 999,600 years to get capitalism. In some other rewinding of the tape, it might take 200,000 years. But eventually, you're going to get it. So why do I believe that? Well, I think I believe it basically for close to historical materialist arguments. I don't believe it for the fettering argument. That is, the particular argument that is actually in Marx seems too abstract a way of thinking about it. Or it's not that it's too abstract, it doesn't seem to really capture the stage transition problem well enough to say that it's by virtue of the relations being fettered, the relations fettering the development, that the relations are changed. Rather, my intuitions are more around this hybridization idea, that with enough time you're going to get hybrid forms emerge, in which then internal to a structure you're having multiple relations of production coexisting, because they will emerge endogenously because they're adaptive. The systems will be more flexible in that way, and that hybridization is what then leads to metamorphosis. Leads to a transformation. That's not Marx's argument, but it's Marxoid. It's, you know, it has a Marxian character to it, but it's not Marx's own argument about it, or Cohen's. That's the way I kind of think about why the, if you run the tape 1,000 times, eventually you'll get a pre-capitalist society in which there's enough space for markets that those markets will develop in these proto-capitalist ways, and it'll serve interests of ruling classes to fuel resources into it, because they'll be able to beat off their rivals better by strengthening that, and eventually that's going to precipitate the emergence of proper capitalism, and then the game's over. I mean, the game of pre-capitalism is over. Yeah.
So do you think if you ran the tape 1,000 times, you'd get something after capitalism too?
Well, that's, see, the problem with the running the tape, so running the tape 1,000 times, you get capitalism. The best account I can give as to why that's true is because of hybridization in pre-capitalist relations, that capitalism emerges into spaces, forms these more complex ecosystems, and then it takes off. So then you get capitalism, and it also has hybridization. It also has multiple forms. But I can't make a prediction as to what the theory then is too underspecified to say anything about where that culminates. So I don't believe that if you run it 1,000 times with enough time, you'll eventually get human emancipation, for sure. I don't have any basis for making the positive prediction. What I am prepared to say, but this may be, this is something we'll be discussing both on the weekend and on our last class, I mean on the Sunday morning. So what I can't really distinguish is how much wishful thinking is in this, you know, sort of the optimism of the will, and how much well-grounded theory there is here. What I can say is that the possibilities of emancipatory alternatives will always be present. But I don't have a transformation thesis that's strong enough to say, and those possibilities will eventually be realized. Because the capacity for transformation, I don't see any inherent reason why the capacity grows with the possibility. The capacity for transformation could be permanently blocked by all sorts of forces. Yeah.
Yeah, so a sort of similar question. Do you think that all of the stages leading up to capitalism would be identical, or would they? Would there be some sort of variation there?
Well, so Cohen's solution to that is a pretty smart one, but it ends up thinning out the theory a lot. There's only one stage between primitive egalitarian communalism and capitalism, and it's everything else. It's pre-capitalist class relations. Now, what characterizes all of them, and which therefore does justify saying these are all variants on a theme, they all involve the extraction of surplus through the direct application of force. Whether it be tributary forms, as in China, you know, Imperial China, you'd have peasant communities that were pretty egalitarian, not entirely, but you know, there was a lot of cooperative work done. And they were taxed by imperial authorities that had their representatives in the regions who were quasi, you know, you could think of this as sort of feudalish, but it wasn't feudal in the way that European feudalism. The peasants were not their personal dependents in the way they were in Europe. But nevertheless, was the coercive extraction of surplus. That's characteristic of the tributary form of exploitation. So you had all sorts of varieties of that. You had ordinary slavery, You had serfdom, which is quasi-slavery. You had feudalism, which was a different form. You had, you had monetized feudalism, which was a different form. You had tributary modes of production, and all sorts of other combinations. But they all had coercive extraction. And that seems to me a reasonable idea, that the successor to primitive communalism will be some militaristic form of extraction of surplus. I suspect the way it actually worked was through conquest rather than subordination of internal groups. And I think that's there's quite a lot of evidence that early agrarian civilizations acquired slaves through conquest rather than from enslaving segments of their indigenous, you know, their own community. And then in some of those varieties of coercive extraction, in some contingent contexts, autonomous merchant activity becomes possible. Certainly in China it was possible. There was lots of merchant activity, even long-distance merchant activity. It was a very vibrant market economy. My guess is for China, you know, so I'm of the in the camp that if Europe didn't exist, eventually China would have become capitalist. Just might have taken another couple thousand years, but it seemed to have a leisurely pace at being able to develop these things. It was clearly able to develop new technologies. It was clearly engaged in all sorts of commercial and merchant activity. The rigidity of its political institutions and its educational structures and all this stuff, I just don't buy the argument that that would permanently block the development of a more dynamic form of, you know, merchant activity that would become capitalist. But, you know, that's speculation because we just don't know.
So, this is kind of unrelated a little bit, but do you think that Marx really thought that the destruction of capitalism would lead to socialism or some emancipatory alternative, as scientifically as he maybe made some of the other arguments, or that it was more kind of in the spirit of what really matters for transformation is what people think is possible for transformation, so that it was more of a kind of mobilizing strategy? So like if we set forth, people will organize for this.
So he never said that.
Yeah.
So I don't know what's in his heart, so to speak. Right. As we'll see when we, on Thursday, the central feature of Marx's theory of the special theory of capitalism is a very strong deterministic prediction about the demise of capitalism, that it becomes an unsustainable social structure. So that's what's predicted. What comes after? Well, I personally think his theory of what comes after is where there's a will, there's a way. You know, it's basically a voluntaristic theory of the future beyond capitalism and a deterministic theory of the demise of capitalism the way I would characterize how he actually develops it. Because he doesn't develop any real arguments that are very credible about why, of necessity, in the aftermath of the end of capitalism, a democratic egalitarian alternative is constructed. What he shows is that human beings under those conditions, the mass of human beings will have an interest in such an alternative because their lives would go better under it. That seems reasonable enough. And that capitalism will forge a homogeneity of conditions of people under capitalism so that they won't have to overcome all sorts of divisions in order to act on that interest. That also seems plausible, even if it turns out not to be true. And that the forces that would oppose it will be in such disarray by virtue of the collapse of capitalism that they won't be able to block it. Again, that's not so unreasonable. So there's all these kinds of ideas in the deterministic part of the theory, which set the stage for a positive hope with a little bit of expectation. But basically, the quip, which also is characteristic of this era of theory construction, socialism or barbarism, actually I think is a better way of thinking about it, where barbarism is just a rhetorical name for all the less desirable alternatives. You know, after all, in science fiction and science fantasy, in the post-apocalyptic collapse of corrupt and disintegrating modernity, mostly it's neo-feudalism, you know. Think of Star Wars, it's princesses and emperors and, you know, it's a kind of neo-feudal world that gets recreated, not emancipation. There's very few apocalyptic stories that end with human emancipation at the far end of collapse. It's usually dystopic, neo-feudal. Okay, on Thursday, we will interrogate the special theory of capitalism and see where it both has some very strong components, but also problematic, particularly around the transformation problem. Okay.